Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Oncology Grand Rounds. We're really excited to be able to put on this series of webinars. This is our first of what will be 11 over the next month or so. We've been coming to the Oncology Nursing Society Congress for 12 years doing satellites, and this year we're going to be doing them this way through a virtual mechanism. This is the agenda for what we're going to talk about here tonight. There's a lot to cover, a lot of new agents, so many more than there were 3 or 4 years ago. Really an exciting time. We're going to start out talking about HER2-positive breast cancer. I think it's really taken a lead in terms of some novel strategies that are starting to come even into other cancers. We'll talk about the treatment of localized HER2-positive disease as well as metastatic, and in particular, the new agents. So there are two really important ones that just came into practice in the last few weeks, and there's others on the way. Then we're going to talk about the use of immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors. That's going to be a major theme throughout all these 11 meetings. It's hard to think of even one where we're not going to be talking about immunotherapy. So tonight we're going to introduce that subject. Finally, immunotherapy came to breast cancer in the form of triple negative disease, and we'll talk about what's going on with that, both metastatic, maybe upfront in the local setting, and then a new antibody drug conjugate that, again, just was approved a few days ago. And we're going to talk about another really important advance in breast cancer, the use of PARP inhibitors. We know PARP inhibitors now being used in ovarian cancer and pancreatic cancer and prostate cancer. And we're going to talk about it in breast cancer as well and how we pick patients to use it. And finally, we'll finish out talking about ER-positive disease. And today we're going to focus mainly on metastatic disease, where there's some really new and exciting agents. And then finally, if you have a few minutes at the end, we're going to chat a little bit about how the pandemic has affected breast cancer management. This has been a theme that we've been introducing into all our work. So we're going to start out talking about HER2-positive disease, and in particular, the management of people who present with localized disease. And to sort of get into that, we put together a few questions. These were in your poll, but we want to kind of go through these as a way to really sort of get into this issue of how these patients are managed. And so, Joyce, we presented a patient here who presents with a 2.5 centimeter mass that's palpable. The patient could feel it. It's estrogen receptor negative, but HER2 positive. We know about half of these patients are ER negative, half ER positive. She was ER negative. And she actually had a palpable lymph node that was positive also. And so, Joyce, the question is, well, when you see a patient is presenting with de novo breast cancer, regardless of what it is, any of the three diseases, are you going to take the patient to surgery and then think about systemic therapy afterwards, or are you going to give systemic therapy up front, so-called neoadjuvant therapy? In this situation, Joyce, what would you be thinking? And in general, how do you think through this question of people with HER2-positive breast cancer?
So the most important thing with regard to who should get preoperative therapy is it critical in the optimal management of the breast cancer to know at the time of surgery, if they get preoperative therapy first and then go to surgery, is it critical to know whether they've had a pathologic complete response, meaning no cancer left in breast and lymph nodes, versus still having residual disease? Because we now have for both HER2-positive breast cancer as well as triple-negative breast cancer, we have additional therapies we give post-operatively in the adjuvant setting only for patients who still had residual disease. So if we do surgery first and then do adjuvant post-operative therapy, we've lost the opportunity to know how responsive the patient's breast cancer was to the upfront preoperative therapy. So truthfully, that's become the most important reason to do preoperative therapy. And HER2-positive breast cancer is clearly in that category. We always give, really, maybe with the possible exception of stage one disease, and that's a debatable issue, but certainly this patient looks like she's got stage two disease, 2.5 centimeters, positive node, clearly a woman who should receive trastuzumab and pertuzumab, the two anti-HER2 antibodies, along with chemotherapy. Generally, I utilize the docetaxel and the carboplatin every 3 weeks for 6 cycles. Then she goes to surgery. If she has a pathologic complete response, which for an estrogen receptor negative, HER2 positive woman is in the order of 60-70 plus percent, if she has a PAF CR, she just finishes up the year of the trastuzumab and pertuzumab, you know, in her case, along with radiation therapy, because even though she has a PAF CR, she started off with a positive lymph node. She would need radiation even if she had a mastectomy outside of a clinical trial. But if she's got residual disease, she's already had the TCHP preoperatively, she still has residual disease, the standard of care is to switch her over postoperatively to get 14 treatments of T-DM1, the antibody drug conjugate.
We'll talk a little bit about what an antibody drug conjugate is in a second. But what we've seen in general, even in patients who have no nodes, you know, no evidence of disease in the axilla, is people giving neoadjuvant therapy if the tumor is 2 centimeters or greater, which this woman fits in both categories. Just kind of curious, Marissa, you know, patients come in when they know they have breast cancer and think there's probably a lot of anxiety, of course, to get the surgery. How do they respond when you discuss the idea of getting chemotherapy and anti-HER therapy before the surgery?
I just always explain to them, you know, the importance of all the receptors and everything we look at with the pathology before we even really get going on their treatment, and just explain to them how closely we monitor them to make sure they're responding well every time they come in for treatment. And I think as patients, you know, as you educate them and explain things, they feel more comfortable. And that's, you know, developing that relationship and telling them every time they come in, we'll be teaching you and talking to you about side effects. So I think just reassuring them, and as they get to know you, you develop, of course, a relationship. But I think the more you educate people, the more informed they are, the more comfortable they are as they get going.
And of course, Daniel, now we really have a new strategy, as Joyce was talking about giving treatment before surgery. And then if there's residual disease, to use another form of treatment, which in breast cancer, we'll go through the study that showed this, is T-DM1. I'm going to ask you in a second, you have a couple patients who got T-DM1 in this situation. I'm going to ask you to comment a little bit on how patients do during, this is really adjuvant T-DM1. In the past, we've always given it as the treatment for metastatic disease, and now we're giving it as adjuvant. How do you find patients tolerating T-DM1, Daniel, in the adjuvant setting, particularly as compared to in the past when they got it for metastatic disease?
Well, typically, I haven't had too many issues thus far giving it. Typically, the biggest side effect I've seen thus far is usually just some fatigue, nausea. I do have a current patient right now that's on T-DM1. Her T-bill has actually increased, and so we may have to dose reduce her medication just because of the effects on her T-bill. So things like that have recently popped up. But typically, in most cases, patients typically respond well to the treatment versus chemotherapy. They don't get as much side effects like the nausea, the vomiting, the hair loss. So patients typically do much better once they're on the anti-HER2 antibody treatments.
So Virginia, maybe you can talk a little bit about how you explain to someone what an antibody drug conjugate is. We have T-DM1. We're going to talk about this new agent, sacituzumab. But it actually kind of, I mean, it's not chemotherapy, but it sort of includes a chemotherapy molecule. And I guess one of the things that you can maybe go through is sort of how it works.
So when I talk to patients, I try to simplify it and I try to explain that this is almost like a nuclear trastuzumab. It's trastuzumab plus chemotherapy, but because the chemotherapy is on the antibody, it doesn't get dispersed into the whole body. It usually just goes to the cancer cells. And that's the beauty of it, that it doesn't cause, as Daniel mentioned, a lot of the side effects that we see with chemotherapy. It's a little bit more targeted. Now, you may have heard of the Trojan horse description of these antibodies, and this may be a little too complicated for patients, but for nurses and our nurse practitioners, it's great to help them understand of how this works, and it's really fascinating of how oncology has been able to use these drugs where you have the antibody, the linker, and the toxin, and that complex gets internalized into the cell, then the toxin gets released into the nucleus or the cytoplasm and kills the cancer cell.
So we're going to go through some of the research studies that sort of led into this. I just want to walk you through a few of the questions we asked, just to, again, to kind of think to yourself how you might ask them. As we were just talking before, now in HER2 positive disease, when patients have surgery, they still have residual cancer after having neoadjuvant therapy. The approach is T-DM1. We'll show you the trial that changed practice about a year and a half ago. We'll talk a little bit about pertuzumab that's often used in the neoadjuvant setting. We know that diarrhea is a common problem. When we get into the cases, so we'll chat a little bit about how that sort of plays out. And finally, the other issue we wanted to bring up is the issue of post-adjuvant therapy treatment. I think this is probably the first time in oncology we've actually seen this, where people go through a full course of adjuvant chemotherapy, or in this case with anti-HER therapy, Joyce, and then they get a second wave of therapy, so-called post-adjuvant therapy with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor and neratinib. We'll talk about that as it relates to metastatic disease as well. But I guess, Joyce, the strange thing about this is it looks like the patients who are ER positive benefit better. Any comment on that?
Yes, you know, for breast cancers that are estrogen receptor positive and HER2 positive, I always tell patients that we really know what's driving this breast cancer. It turns out you really have to block both. If you block one, then if you block the estrogen receptor, then the HER2 comes up as a mechanism of escape of the breast cancer. And conversely, if you just block HER2, estrogen receptor comes up. And so if you block them both, very, very powerful. That's what the cancer cell is dependent on. So it's very fortunate that we know that and we can block them both, and it's really effective.
So this is actually an anti-HER tyrosine kinase inhibitor. We know that one of the problems when it was first being utilized was diarrhea, Daniel. And you've had a couple of patients you're going to present. Well, actually one who's getting it now, actually. What we've been hearing is that with a lot of attention to preventing diarrhea, these patients do fairly well. Daniel, what's your experience been with neratinib?
Initially, typically the diarrhea is always the biggest concern for patients. So our nurses or I will, you know, educate the patient as far as like what therapies we utilize to help minimize this side effect. So we follow up our patients pretty closely and they call us too when they have symptoms. Thankfully, the packaging for neratinib kind of really spells out, you know, how to utilize the anti-diarrhea prophylaxis, like the loperamide, the budesonide, how to use it, how to utilize it. So we kind of go over that with the patient. And usually, you know, using those methods, we can typically minimize the diarrhea effect so the patient can remain on treatment, because the whole point is to keep them on the treatment. But in some cases, we have had some patients where even with anti-diarrheal prophylaxis, they still weren't unable to get that symptom controlled and they have dropped off. But typically, we try to get that control so we can keep them on as much as possible to finish the whole year.
I saw a question pop up about the dose escalation, and I think that's been a big part of the mitigation of the diarrhea that was so profound when we first started with this. So speaking of diarrhea, and I'm sorry, but that comes up a lot in oncology. Mm-hmm. And Marissa, we know that pertuzumab, the anti-HER antibody, is a second anti-HER antibody that seems to add to trastuzumab. It is typically used in a neoadjuvant situation. TCHP is a common therapy. And then in patients who have high-risk disease after surgery, it's often used. Any comments, Marissa, about your experience? Sometimes it may be hard to separate out what's the pertuzumab, what's the chemo, et cetera. But diarrhea has been an issue that has been a problem with patients. In general, what's your experience been with pertuzumab, Marissa?
I think overall patients, as long as they're, you know, mentally prepared, like we do treatment review to discuss, you know, prepare them for possible side effects they may have. I just always, you know, of course we talk about diarrhea forever, it seems like, but, you know, we just discuss the importance of really stopping it, you know, controlling it. If you're not controlling it with the medications we give you, then you have to notify our office so that we can come in and have patients get fluids, hydration, get labs if they need to. So, you know, it's definitely, I just always emphasize that patients have to be open in their lines of communication with us. If we don't know that they're having issues, then it can get out of control if they wait 4 or 5 days to call the office, you know, with diarrhea. So I really emphasize that when I talk to patients so that they know, you know, the importance of checking in with us if they're having issues with diarrhea. But overall, I think patients do okay. It's just preparing them up front so that they're educated and know how many stools are too many and when to call us and manage that from home ideally.
So I want to run through a few slides that sort of kind of underlay these strategies that we're talking about. I should also say we call this rounds because, you know, there's no beginning or end to it. You know, we're going to talk about some stuff today. Hopefully you'll pick some stuff up that'll help you with patients, but we could easily spend like all day going through this stuff. And, you know, it's just a little bit of a tasting menu. And so Virginia, I'd say this is one of the most exciting trials that ever has come out in breast cancer. This came out at the San Antonio meeting, not this past one, but the one before, a big randomized study where they compared T-DM1 to trastuzumab. And these were people who had neoadjuvant therapy and still had residual disease. Virginia, can you talk a little bit about what the risk is of recurrence in a patient? Joyce was saying 60, 70% of patients, or certainly more than half, will have path CR. They have a cancer, maybe it's in the axilla, they go to surgery, nothing is found. So that's the typical situation. But for those patients compared to people who have residual disease, Virginia, how much of a risk is it that they will develop metastatic disease and death?
The risk increases substantially, and it depends on how much residual disease they have as well. But if you have a PCR, the thought is that 15 to 25% of these patients may actually recur, their cancers may recur. But if you do have residual disease, that may increase to 40 to even 80%, depending on the magnitude of the residual disease.
So if we take a look at the study to see, you know, we're not going to show a lot of curves, but we're going to show some of the ones that are most dramatic. And Joyce, this is really almost shocking when you look at it, how much the risk of recurrence decreased. I don't think anybody was necessarily expecting it. That doesn't look like a huge difference. But if you look at the numbers, one of the things that we always try to emphasize is the hazard rate, HR. And if I can get my pointer to work down here, you see it. Hazard rate 0.5. What that means is the risk of having metastatic disease is cut in half, a huge bump. Joyce, can you talk a little bit about how the oncologist reacted to this? It looked, as we know from metastatic disease, it seemed that the T-DM1 was well tolerated, perhaps a lot better tolerated than chemotherapy might be. But Joyce, can you comment on the findings of this study?
Yeah, it was a striking result and a very, I think, unexpected result, because T-DM1 is trastuzumab conjugated, chemically attached to a powerful chemotherapy agent, but it's a microtubule targeted agent similar to our taxanes, although it is a different class of drugs, but the same target. So it was remarkably effective. It was an 11% absolute improvement in invasive disease-free survival. So the risk of recurrence of invasive disease, 11%. That was basically in the same order as adding the trastuzumab onto the chemotherapy in the beginning. And I don't think we ever thought we'd see that magnitude of benefit ever again in the HER2-positive, you know, early stage disease. So it was a strikingly positive. And, you know, it changed practice overnight. The results were so strong. It just, anybody with any residual disease in their breast or lymph nodes at surgery automatically gets 14 treatments of the T-DM1 once they recover from their surgery.
So just to be clear, though, in terms of that, what about the patients who have path CRs, Joyce? What's their prognosis? And they typically might get trastuzumab and pertuzumab, for example. What is their prognosis, and why don't they get T-DM1?
The prognosis of women who have a pathologic complete response, path CR, is really very good. Several trials say it's about 93% chance of remaining disease-free, maybe even 90 to 95% chance of remaining disease-free indefinitely. The ER-positive patients may have a bit of a higher risk over time of some recurrence. The ER-negative HER2-positive really probably are sitting at 93 to 95%. The package insert for pertuzumab in the FDA says that if we give the pertuzumab preoperatively, we should give adjuvant pertuzumab after surgery. Sometimes what happens is patients who have a T2 breast cancer, let's say 3 centimeters, clinically node negative, so they're not starting off super high risk and they have a pathological complete response with preoperative trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and chemotherapy. Sometimes the temptation is to stop the pertuzumab postoperatively and just treat with trastuzumab. But the package insert basically says if we start with the pertuzumab, we should continue the pertuzumab. And furthermore, we really care about the long-term systemic effects. The breast is great. It's great to get that path CR, but what we really care about is no metastatic disease developing in vital organs over time. And that brings us to the AFFINITY adjuvant trial of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And there, those patients got a year of the trastuzumab and pertuzumab and had an improvement in their invasive disease-free survival if, again, they were node positive to start off with. So that was node positive disease. The thing about giving the preoperative trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and chemotherapy, we don't really know for sure who is node negative. We can kind of tell who's node positive for sure. You know, you can feel it, you can see it on imaging studies, et cetera, but we don't know for sure who is node negative.
That sort of ties into the next thing that I wanted to mention, because we kind of want to flip through these things so we can talk about these new agents. I'm just going to very briefly comment on this. I think this is what you're alluding to, Joyce. The so-called ATTEMPT trial looking at node-negative patients, lower-risk patients. We already know that using trastuzumab with paclitaxel seems to be very effective for these low-risk patients. Now we have another option, T-DM1. It looks like the benefits were about the same. So you really have seen over the last couple of years, T-DM1 basically coming into the adjuvant setting. We talked about neratinib and the trial that looked at it afterwards. This is what I was talking about. If you look here in the neratinib study, and you see overall on the left, you see that the orange, there are less recurrences in the green and the overall, but all that benefit is in HR positive patients. So if you look at the HR positive on the middle, you see a big difference between neratinib and not, and you don't see it for the HR negative on the right. Looks like we got to put those on that slide too. And this is what we were talking about, the new approach to preventing diarrhea that seems to be so effective. Dose escalation and aggressive use of preventive medications. And we can see that diarrhea then has been much, much lower with this kind of strategy, including discontinuation. I don't want to go through all the details of the cases that we have here today, but Daniel, you have this 56-year-old lady, and she actually went through the entire T-DM1 cycle. She had neoadjuvant therapy, just like we've been talking about, TCHP. She had a lot of residual disease there, and ended up getting T-DM1 and then neratinib. Anything you want to say in general about how she tolerated the T-DM1 and neratinib, Daniel?
This patient's currently still on the T-DM1 right now. She's almost finished.
She's
pending cycle 12.
Right.
And she completed cycle 11, but we did notice that her T-Billy's been trending upwards. Because if you actually look at the FDA package insert, it says T-Billy greater than 1.0 to hold it. So this last time she came in last week, her T-Billy was 1.29. So for right now, we actually held it. I'm going to see her, I think, this week. And we're going to recheck her T-Billy level to see if we can move forward with treatment.
Your other case is the one, I got those two confused. This is the 43-year-old lady is the one who already is on neratinib.
Yes.
How did she do with the T-DM1 and neratinib?
She did fine. The neratinib, the main issue with her initially was obviously the diarrhea. But we kind of followed kind of like what the package insert tells us about using the loperamide and the budesonide. And we kind of used those in conjunction together. And initially she did have a bit of a hard time with the neratinib, but after about a month of treatment, she was able to diarrhea pretty much resolved. And as of right now, she's been on it for quite a few months now without any issue, really. So she's doing pretty good. It was just that initial month is like usually the tough period trying to really get that diarrhea controlled. Once we can get past, hopefully, the first 4 weeks, usually they can continue on to complete therapy.
I'm going to talk a little bit about management of metastatic disease. And, you know, as you can see, T-DM1 started out in metastatic disease. Now it's in adjuvant therapy. Same thing with pertuzumab. So we'll see whether that happens with some of these new agents. There are two in particular that were just approved that we really want to focus on. One is tucatinib, which is another tyrosine kinase inhibitor. You can tell by the N being nib. So, for example, like lapatinib is also a TKI, small molecule. Trastuzumab deratuxan, we'll talk about that, and also the black box warning in terms of toxicity, but a very stunningly effective drug. And we had a couple of patients that were going to talk about that. And Joyce, can you talk a little bit about what trastuzumab deratuxan is and how it's playing out in your patients? You sent us a case of a patient, a 55-year-old woman, who seemed to do really well on that. What is this agent, Joyce?
Well, it's another antibody drug conjugate, just like the TDM1. It's trastuzumab now conjugated chemically attached to a very powerful brand new chemotherapy agent that's similar to irinotecan that's used in colon cancer. It has known activity in breast cancer. So it's a brand new mechanism of action. And as was said earlier, it's a Trojan horse. You know, the trastuzumab hooks onto the cancer cell, and this cancer cell brings the trastuzumab inside, and then the chemotherapy is released inside. However, this chemo drug can then diffuse over to other cells that may have very low levels of HER2 or be HER2 negative, and it can go through the membrane of other cells and kill neighboring cancer cells as well. It's a very, very powerful drug.
So, Virginia, one of the things that's really interesting about this, if you look at, go back to the slide, the so-called waterfall plot, we'll show many of these as we go through this whole series. But basically, each one of these sticks represents one patient and which way their tumor went. If it goes down, that's good. It means it shrunk. And it looks like almost all of these shrink. Can you talk a little bit, Virginia, about the efficacy of this agent as you've observed it, but also the tolerability issues? We see this thing about black box warning. What's that about?
We love this sort of waterfall plot. We don't see this that often. This is pretty exciting. This trial was a simple phase 2 study. Patients were heavily pretreated, and so to see a response rate of a little over 60% and most of the patients having at least stable disease was pretty impressive. But everything good comes with something potentially bad, and in this case, it was interstitial lung disease, which we know is seen in other agents such as T-DM1 and other chemotherapeutic drugs such as docetaxel, so it's not unheard of. But in this case, it was a little bit higher than what we had seen previously. Some deaths, mostly in higher doses of the medication, but we're still trying to understand exactly what it is. This is a very potent antibody drug conjugate, has a lot of toxins, has 7 toxins per antibody. So a lot more than T-DM1 does, which is usually 3.
So when a patient asks you sort of what to expect and what the risk is that they're going to have a serious problem like this lung problem, Virginia, what's your estimate for them? And also beyond this unusual problem with the lungs, how do patients feel on the drug?
As you saw from the study, around 13% of patients have had any grade interstitial lung disease. So definitely something that we see all the time. We're still trying to understand. And these patients on the study were warned about it. The physicians knew about it and were told what to do. So this was not something that we were unaware of. Besides the interstitial lung disease, which really all you need to ask your patients is, do you have a dry cough? And if they do, this is really something that we need to get an x-ray for, stop the medication, hold it, and reassess. I've seen achiness, and I've seen a little bit of diarrhea. As Joyce mentioned, the toxin that is associated with it is similar to irinotecan, but it is pretty well tolerated. It isn't
any hair loss?
Very minimal.
That's one thing about these antibody drug conjugates is so great. They're chemotherapy, but they don't really cause chemotherapy side effects.
They're targeted chemotherapy in a sense because they have that antibody. So that's the beauty of it.
So Joyce, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about your clinical experience with this agent, but let's just bring in the other big agent that just was approved, tucatinib. As we're saying, this is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. We already have been using lapatinib for a long time, Joyce. What's the difference between lapatinib, tucatinib, neratinib is another anti-HER therapy? And how did they study it in this big HER2CLIMB trial?
Tucatinib is a pill. It's an oral agent that only blocks the HER2 tyrosine kinase. So the activity of just HER2. Neratinib blocks all of the HER family. Lapatinib blocks HER2 and EGFR, which is otherwise known as HER1. When you block HER1, which both neratinib and lapatinib do, you get diarrhea. So with tucatinib, you don't get much diarrhea, and patients feel quite well on it. The HER2CLIMB trial gave patients who had already had pertuzumab, and they already had T-DM1. A lot of times we go on to a capecitabine-trastuzumab combination there. So that's what they used as their backbone, and it was with or without the tucatinib. So 3 drugs versus 2. And there was a placebo for the tucatinib, and there was a dramatic reduction in the risk of progression of disease. There was an improvement in overall survival. Women lived longer with the tucatinib, which is always a major home run. And then super, super important to us, the patients who had brain metastases who entered the trial, even if the brain metastases had not been treated, they had had no radiation, no surgery, or if the brain metastases had been treated with radiation, but now were progressing or new ones were developing, they were also eligible for the trial. Those patients had the same control of their disease, the same progression-free survival as women did who didn't have brain metastasis. And at ASCO, within a week, we're going to hear all about the details of what happened exactly in terms of the response rate and the control of the disease in the brain. But it's quite clear that these women had control in their brain metastasis, just the same as they had control in their liver or lung metastasis. So this is a dramatic step forward for us, particularly with regard to control of brain metastases.
And Marissa, I guess, you know, we're used to seeing problems with these TKIs. People feel tired. You know, you see that with lapatinib in the past, neratinib, we talked about diarrhea, et cetera. It seems maybe because tucatinib is more targeted that you maybe see less of that. I don't know, Marissa, if you have any comments about these kinds of side effects.
You know, I mean, I think in general, everyone's kind of different. I know I have had some patients with more diarrhea on the tucatinib, but when it's combined with capecitabine, I think that's when, you know, all of us kind of worry more, just like with capecitabine plus neratinib. It's always kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, how's the diarrhea going to be? So I think it just depends on who it is. But in general, you know, we monitor them really closely like we always do and do our best to manage it.
So yeah, that is a really great point about the capecitabine. And Virginia, you and Joyce both gave us a couple of cases of people who actually got tucatinib. And it was interesting for both of you, they got little or not that much capecitabine. This woman had it discontinued. How important, Virginia, is it to sort of get the capecitabine in your point of view? This woman, I guess, ended up really more on tucatinib trastuzumab.
I think when you look at all of the HER2 trials, there's usually a little bit of chemotherapy with them, and it does make a difference in response rate. When you're looking at trastuzumab response rates, that might be in the 30% rate single agent. But when you add chemotherapy, that'll jump up to 60% or so. So definitely a difference there. But for a patient like this, she's 75. She's had many other agents. She's had issues with cytopenias. She was intolerant of capecitabine when combined to lapatinib prior to the tucatinib's approval. So that's why I felt that giving her chemotherapy in combination with trastuzumab and tucatinib was probably not going to serve her much. And she ended up doing pretty well with tucatinib and trastuzumab.
So I guess another combination with capecitabine, I think you were referring to, is neratinib. So neratinib, capecitabine now approved to treat metastatic disease. Again, the hope is that there'll be more benefit in these patients. Joyce, this is a woman, when you hear interstitial lung disease, we already got a couple comments in the chat room, you know, how's COVID? Is that going to be confused with COVID and the whole issue? Hopefully we'll get to that. But we will be talking about that a lot over these 11 meetings, where things are today and how it's affecting the way we do things. But Joyce, you know, with this concern, it sounds a little scary to have something like a black box. But on the other hand, you see patients who really have, and that's a minority of patients, you see patients who really do well. What happened with this lady here, your 55-year-old lady? It seems like she had a pretty scary problem there in her axilla from what I could see.
Yes, this is a lovely 55-year-old woman from Vietnam. She really doesn't speak English, but her son or her daughter always with her, really wonderful family. And, you know, we could not get her axillary disease to respond. She developed a recurrent disease in the axilla very soon after she had had her preoperative TCHP, and it really didn't respond very well. She had a considerable residual disease, including axillary disease. She got the TDM1. But very soon after finishing that and radiation therapy, she recurred in her axilla, diffuse kind of nodules. Biopsy, still ER negative, HER2 positive, and she was treated with a variety of other agents such as capecitabine, trastuzumab. We put her on a clinical trial we have of ibrutinib plus trastuzumab, and she just really wasn't getting benefit. And now the disease in her axilla had kind of coalesced into this flat area just under the arm and just up in the upper arm. And she also, I didn't mention it, she had considerable pulmonary metastasis. I forgot of this. She was getting to the point where she was really being driven crazy by this dry cough, 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 you know, all the time. She couldn't, you know, gabapentin was not helping it. So she still had an excellent performance status, but she was getting pretty discouraged. And I said to myself, when I saw the results of this, I said, whoa, this trastuzumab deruxtecan is quite the agent. after one cycle, she wasn't coughing anymore. And you could tell that the axillary disease was way down. And I can't feel it now. She's had, I think, 3 cycles and she's tolerating it beautifully. No hair loss in her particular case. She's having a little nausea for a few days after each cycle, but not really any loose stools and everything. Now her cough has gone away. So I'll be able to ask her, does she have any dry cough or any shortness of breath? Because I feel like as long as we catch it early, get a CT scan and pick up the ILD right away and get steroids started, I feel personally confident that the patients will be okay, just from my previous experience with a lot of ILD over the years.
What an amazing case. You know, it can be such a terrible problem to have uncontrolled local recurrence. Let's go on to our next topic. We're going to start to pick up the pace here a little bit. We're going to talk about triple negative disease and particularly the entree of checkpoint inhibitors into metastatic disease, specifically the atezolizumab nab-paclitaxel combination. I'm just going to run through a couple of questions just to kind of get you warmed up for that. So we know that this combination, as you'll see, is not for everybody with metastatic breast cancer, but specifically triple negative metastatic disease, PD-L1 positive. We'll talk a little bit about that. I think we've all seen many of these kinds of schemas for how checkpoint inhibitors work. We'll get into that over the next 11 meetings and the whole issue with toxicity, whether or not to treat patients with prior autoimmune disease. We're going to be getting into all that. So we saw as soon as that trial came out last fall, everybody started to take that approach in metastatic disease. But now, as often happens in oncology, we're about to see some new data. Joyce referred to the fact that the ASCO meeting's coming up. It'll be virtual. We'll be telling you over the next month a lot of the presentations and the new data, including this one. And now we're going to see whether pembrolizumab will work in the same situation now with some different chemotherapy. So that might open up the options. Virginia, can you talk a little bit about this study, the IMPASSION 130 study that really changed practice immediately as soon as people saw it? What did they look at there? What did they find? And what do you think it means?
So this was a clinical trial in patients with triple negative metastatic breast cancer, and it was the first line therapy. Patients were randomized to either receive nab-paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel plus atezolizumab. And what was seen in the clinical trial was that there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival, a significant improvement of 8 months in overall survival. And really, that's really what caught most people's attention. Now, that improvement was only in the patient population that was PD-L1 positive by SP142, and that is the assay that is being used on all the atezolizumab clinical trials. So the 40 or so percent of triple negative breast cancer patients that will have a positive PD-L1 test by that assay will significantly benefit by the addition of atezolizumab.
We'll see a case of a patient actually was treated that way, but as we mentioned, we're going to see some data in the upcoming ASCO meeting from another checkpoint inhibitor, pembrolizumab, used in the same exact situation. We'll see how those results compare indirectly. We'll get back to this in a second when we go through the case, but just a word about this other antibody drug conjugate. We're not even halfway through. I think we've already talked about 3 of them. But Joyce, I know you call this SASE. I'm always looking for good nicknames for drugs. I really like SASE, just approved really a few days ago. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about that, Joyce, but the bottom line is, do you see effective responses in a way, manner, similar to what you described for your patient who got trastuzumab deratoxin? Is this kind of a similar situation?
It is a similar situation, and it's for triple negative breast cancer, approved now by the FDA. It's, again, another antibody drug conjugate with an antibody that really binds virtually to all triple negative breast cancer, so you don't have to tests like we have to test for HER2. You don't have to test for the protein on the triple negative. And again, it delivers an agent that is also a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. Interestingly, the same family of compound, of cytotoxic agent as the trastuzumab deruxtecan. Very, very powerful. Again, non-cross resistant. I've seen very durable responses in heavily pretreated triple negative breast cancer patients, and also it also works quite well in estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative patients, but the big phase 3 is going on now, but I'm sure that that will be approved as well down the road.
So we want to go through this case of Marissa as a 67-year-old woman who got this therapy. But first, Virginia, you know, a big question in oncology right now is how do you figure out who's going to benefit from a checkpoint inhibitor? we know in lung cancer, when you're going to have two symposium in lung cancer, we often give it in metastatic disease combined with chemotherapy. Other times we use it as a single agent. And right now it's kind of hard to figure out. We have some people who do fantastic, you know, live 5 years with metastatic disease, for example, in lung cancer, and others who don't. So try to predict who benefit at all. What exactly is PD-1, Virginia? How do you measure it? And how well correlated is it, for example, in this study with treatment benefit? If it's very high, do you get a lot more benefit?
So PD-1 and PD-L1 are receptors on the surface of a tumor cell, an immune cell, and it really, the connection tells the immune cell that the tumor cell is not a foreign material. And so this connection suppresses the immune response. So if you have inhibitors to either PD-1 or PD-L1, you're basically allowing the immune system to start attacking the cancer cells. Now, PD-L1 staining is usually done on the immune cells, but you can also actually have PD-L1 staining on tumor cells. We just don't take that into account. And as we mentioned previously, there's different drugs have different stains that are associated with their clinical trials. So for atezolizumab, we have the SP142 stain. And if it's positive, then these patients with triple negative breast cancer will benefit from atezolizumab. You quickly showed a slide about the 355 trial, which will be presented at ASCO in the next few days.
Yeah, this is really important. Maybe you can explain that.
It really is. So this is a similar trial to the 130 trial, but with a different checkpoint inhibitor. This one is with pembrolizumab. It's a phase 3 trial. It included a couple different chemotherapeutic drugs plus minus pembrolizumab. And based on the press release, the patients that were PD-L1 positive by yet another pembrolizumab specific now assay received a benefit from pembrolizumab. So we'll have the results in a few days. But based on this trial, it seems that we're going to have a second checkpoint inhibitor approved for triple negative breast cancer.
So I want to go on and talk about the case. But before we do, one other point I just want to bring up, Virginia, and that is the fact that we've also seen data. We were talking about neoadjuvant therapy of HER2-positive disease and, you know, the whole strategy that's coming out there. We're starting to see trials combining checkpoint inhibitors and chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant situation for triple-negative disease. Right now, it seems like we don't have definitive data. Virginia, though, any comments on that strategy? The same thing, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, but now you're adding in a checkpoint inhibitor.
So this was again presented at San Antonio last year and previously at ESMO as well. This was the KEYNOTE 522 trial that gave a backbone of chemotherapy of AC followed by paclitaxel and carboplatin with or without pembrolizumab. And it showed that the addition of pembrolizumab significantly improved pathologic complete response to over 60%. It was 64% or so, which we've never seen before in triple negative breast cancer, but also there was an event-free survival improvement. Now, this was very preliminary. It would be interesting to hear what Joyce usually does. I think her and I discussed this a few months ago, and the consensus was probably to reserve this for pretty high-risk patients, patients with positive lymph nodes, patients with large tumors, because these treatments have toxicities, and it's very important to note that as well, but it's not FDA-approved yet.
So we'll save Joyce's response for the 8-hour version of this because we could talk about this all day long. Such an interesting thing and, you know, so provocative. You know, when we did our triple negative symposium in San Antonio afterwards, the thing that people came up to me the most about was this one specific thing, you know, because you're dealing with the possibility of cure in this situation. And, you know, it's a question is how much data do you need to really change practice? Well, Marissa, we have this 67-year-old woman who, it's amazing, she got treated in 2019. So that was just about the time the data was presented. I think it was, yeah, around that time. What happened? This lady had metastatic disease. It looks like she's had it since 2018. What happened last fall at that point when she got started on the nab-paclitaxel atezolizumab? I see that her PD-L1 level is 1%. What happened there, Marissa?
So she actually completed her primary treatment, her preoperative treatment. They treated her as though she was ERPR negative, HER2 positive. And I think she received about 4 cycles and then was sent to surgery because she didn't respond well. And so anyways, you can see all of her treatment there, but she had gone in for just a routine CT chest follow-up last summer. And they had seen the lung nodules that had shown up. And so they had done full restaging. And she had started seeing us after that time. And Dr. O'Shaughnessy ordered a biopsy on her lung nodule and ended up coming back triple negative. So Dr. O'Shaughnessy started her on the nab-paclitaxel and the atezolizumab in the fall. And so she received 6 cycles of that and had a really, really good response. And she also, I didn't mention, they had done staging and found 2 lesions in the brain, and she had completed SRS also on top of that.
So what's her current status and how's she doing?
So I think Dr. O'Shaughnessy actually saw her last week, but when I had seen her last, we had switched her to atezolizumab alone, but she's been doing really well, I think. Don't you, Dr. O?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. She's great.
Joyce, what happened? They thought she was HER2 positive, and then you did the biopsy and she's triple negative. What happened there?
This is not uncommon, where I think some cancers that are highly genomically unstable, such as triple negative breast cancer, they can look like they're HER2 amplified. A lot of times the IHC will come back 2+. It'll be equivocal because we do know that some triple negatives have a fair amount of HER2 protein, but they're not really amplified. So I think we can get faked out by this genomic instability and a lot of HER2 gene copies, but it's not true amplification. It's not uncommon, unfortunately. We see it.
Interesting. So I guess one more thing, and then we're going to move on. You know, Virginia, one of the things, again, a theme, there's so many themes that are going to go through this series. Every year we talk about the fact that, yeah, we're talking about breast cancer, lung cancer, but we're talking about oncology. And a lot of these, you know, principles really apply across many different fields, many different sort of tumor types. So this lady also had brain mets, I see. And looks like she got treated for those brain mets locally. And then despite that, she got a systemic response to treatment. You know, one of the things, Virginia, that often comes up here is the possibility that this is going to last for a long time. And this really is the lure of immunotherapy. Even when we get to lung cancer, you know, maybe 20% or even less, 10% actually respond. But the exciting thing is this isn't like a few months. You know, you can see, you know, people now in practice talk about stopping immunotherapy and patients are doing well in a couple of years. Do we know yet, Virginia, whether this happens in breast cancer?
We do have some data, and it does happen. It reminds me of the high-dose IL-2 days. We used to admit patients to the hospital and give them very toxic therapy that many of them ended up in the ICU for a 5% cure rate. But 5% of these patients had the potential of being cured. And we see that with breast cancer too. And I have patients where after 6 cycles of chemotherapy with atezolizumab, nab-paclitaxel, I drop the nab-paclitaxel and continue the atezo for a while, and some of them may not recur.
And do you ever, you know, again, this is going to come up in a lot of our other programs, for example, lung cancer, even bladder cancer, believe it or not, nowadays. Do you ever consider stopping therapy? I don't know if, you know, immunotherapy hasn't been around that long for breast cancer, but you know, if you have somebody on atezo at 2 years, they're doing fine. This lady's had a complete response. Would you keep it going? Particularly now with COVID, you don't want to bring people in, et cetera.
So I haven't gotten there yet because the atezo-nab is not really 2 years old, but I had patients on clinical trials and one of them received a PD-L1 inhibitor and the protocol said after 18 months, we should discontinue therapy. And this was a patient that was going to go to hospice before the clinical trial and then was disease-free. And 6 months after discontinuation of the agent, her disease came back. We restarted it on that clinical trial and she didn't get a response at all. What that means is anybody's guess.
So yeah, there's research looking at that we'll talk about in some of these other programs. Let's move on now and talk about our third topic, which is the use of PARP inhibitors in breast cancer. We're doing a program here in ovarian cancer where, of course, that's going to be a huge topic. We're actually doing another program on PARP inhibitors in different cancers. I mentioned there are 4 different cancers. One of these programs, I think Joyce, you're involved with it also, we're going to have investigators of 4 different tumor types talking about PARP, but today we're going to focus on PARP in breast cancer. But in general for PARP, there are a couple of issues that you have to know about. First of all, who is going to get it? And I'm going to ask Joyce to talk a little bit about what PARP inhibitors are and how we figure out who might benefit from them. But the short answer is some kind of mutation testing, and we'll talk about what that is, germline, somatic, or both. And then once you find a patient who, based on these mutation analyses, you think would be more sensitive, for example, a BRCA germline classic inherited situation, when would you use a PARP inhibitor? What stage disease and after what therapies? We know right now there are actually 2 PARP inhibitors approved in breast cancer, olaparib and talazoparib. So a couple just sort of questions to get you warmed up here. So germline mutation is inherited, found in every cell in the body. Somatic mutations are found only in the tumor. So when we get to lung cancer, we'll talk about patients who have EGFR tumor mutations, RAS mutations, RET, et cetera, in just the tumor. But also we see a germline. In terms of the approval, I noticed a lot of people on the pretest got this one incorrect because it's tempting to say both, because we know in ovarian cancer, that's how you use PARP inhibitors. You give chemo and then you follow it with a PARP inhibitor. But in breast cancer, and we'll talk about this, it just uses monotherapy because that's the way the research thought it was done. So let's start out with this, Joyce. If you can talk a little bit about sort of what PARP inhibitors are and how we figure out who's going to benefit from them.
Well, PARP inhibitors are oral agents that block DNA repair. And breast cancers that have a mutation, a woman has inherited a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, her breast cancer has one of those mutations, they don't repair their DNA well at all, because that's what BRCA1 and 2 do, is they repair DNA. And so they are really dependent on other forms of DNA repair, and that's what the PARP inhibitor inhibits. So these cells really die very well with PARP inhibitors that are BRCA1 or 2 positive in the patient's germline. So far, we only have the highest level of evidence for women who have inherited a BRCA1 or 2 mutation and who have metastatic breast cancer, whether it's ER positive, HER2 negative, or triple negative.
Maybe you can comment on this slide, though, Joyce, in terms of the incidence of BRCA germline. If we can put up this slide, it looks like it's higher in triple negative, and maybe that's why we start out with PARP inhibitors there.
Yeah, so the NCCN guidelines said test every metastatic breast cancer patient, regardless of family history, that's HER2 negative. So all of our hormone receptor positives, HER2 negative, and all of our triple negatives. And if you do that, you'll find that 17% of the triple negative patients have a germline inherited BRCA mutation, even if they have no family history, and 6% of the ER positive patients that are also HER2 negative will have an inherited germline mutation in BRCA1 or 2. Now, it's really, you're going to see it more often in ER positive patients because there's so many more ER positive patients. So 6% of a much larger number is a much larger number of BRCA patients that you will find. But we should be doing broad testing for all of our patients.
And you can see that in the patients who have ER positive disease, more commonly BRCA2 than BRCA1, but they both seem to respond to PARP inhibitors. We pulled out this slide, Virginia, because I feel like it's kind of makes more sense to me than a lot of the more complicated things in terms of how these drugs work. You want to take a shot at the famous table chair thing?
Jenny always knows how to simplify things. So as Joyce mentioned, what BRCA does is it impairs DNA from being repaired. But then PARP goes there and can actually repair most of it. And so these cells can become cancerous and so forth. If we get a PARP inhibitor, as seen on this slide, we not only have one leg of the chair that's broken, now we have two legs of the chair broken. The DNA cannot repair itself at all, and then the cell dies.
So in terms of clinical use of these agents, Daniel, the two things that we've heard the most about is cytopenias, particularly things like anemia, but also GI problems, nausea, etc. These are oral agents, which is very helpful. Daniel, any comments about tolerability of this therapy?
I know I had one patient that was on this. She actually did pretty well. We obviously had to monitor her CBCs. And she would get, you know, anemic, but it was never a level that required like blood transfusions, anything like that. And typically the main side effect related to the anemia is the patient would be fatigued. And I would just explain to the patient that that's kind of an expected side effect of the treatment. And, you know, we would continue to monitor their counts just to make sure that, you know, if whatever reason they would ever require blood transfusion, which would be very rare, we would take care of the issue. But typically in most patients that are on these therapies don't typically require that kind of intervention. And usually, you know, they do pretty well in it, honestly. So yeah, we've done pretty good with this so far.
So Virginia, a number of situations in oncology where you have more than one drugs within a class that seem to have similar effects. You don't often see trials that compare, you know, one drug versus another. It's more one drug versus control. That's what we had here. We have two PARP inhibitors. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what the difference is between these two? If any, they kind of seem very, very similar. I'm not sure how you even tell the difference in terms of which one to use Virginia. But can you talk about these studies, what they found, and then what it means to your practice?
Absolutely. And these are almost identical clinical trials, the Olympiad and the EMBRCA. There were trials in patients that were germline BRCA positive, could have been ER positive or ER negative, but HER2 negative. And patients were given either the PARP inhibitor, which was talazoparib or olaparib, or treatment of physician's choice, which was chemotherapy in most of those cases. And both of the cases, as you can see from the graph, if we can magnify it, our audience can see it well, is that both of the drugs improved significantly the progression-free survival. And when you look at the numbers, they're very similar. And the differences really just have to do with different clinical trials and slightly different patient populations. So these drugs were superior to the chemotherapeutic agents that were used. Side effect profiles are similar. You'll have a little bit more anemia with the talazoparib. Otherwise, they're very similar drugs. Olaparib is a twice-a-day medication, and talazoparib is a once-a-day medication. And I have the feeling that's one of the reasons why you may have a little more compliance with talazoparib. So I personally would give talazoparib mostly because of that, but they're almost identical.
I've heard people say that talazoparib causes hair loss. Is that the case?
A little bit more. You know, when you look at the studies, hair loss is graded as grade 1 and grade 2, and grade 1 is a little bit of hair loss, and grade 2 is more hair loss. A little bit more with talazoparib, but these agents are nowhere near the hair loss that we see with chemotherapy.
So just again, to kind of, you know, refresh our memories about how to look at these trial results, you know, if we can put that back on, you can see that what you're looking at is the chance of being progression-free. These are people with metastatic disease, and the question is, are they going to stay that way or progress? And you can see that the top line, which is the treatment line, the progression-free survival all the way along, right from almost the beginning, is higher. So you see there's a difference. And again, if you come back, you can look at the curves, but the key thing to look at is the hazard rates. What fraction of the recurrences or progressions are reduced? And basically you subtract one from this. So both of them are around close to 50%. Joyce, that's a very substantial change, at least in the curves. How do you see this playing out on practice? In a second, Marissa is going to present one of your patients who actually got a PARP inhibitor. But Joyce, any comments in general about efficacy and tolerability? And again, if you see any difference between the two, you know, ovarian cancer, we have three PARP inhibitors that they have to choose from. How about here, Joyce?
So far, we just have the two, and it's, so far, it's just for the germline BRCA 1 or 2s. I consider these two big phase 3s proof of concept, because if you've got an agent that's very highly specific, the way it kills the cancer cell, you really want to use it much earlier in the course of the disease. So either first line for a triple negative patient, if the breast cancer is PD-L1 negative, because if it's positive, then we'll be using atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel right now, and maybe pembrolizumab after ASCO. And for the ER-positive patients, we're going to use the CDK4/6 inhibitors first. But then, and if a person has a PIK3CA mutation, we may give them alpelisib. But then, before we think about chemotherapy, that would be the time to go ahead and use one of the PARP inhibitors for our germline BRCA patients, because that 50% reduction in the risk of progression is going to give that many more months to patients if you give it earlier in the course of the breast cancer.
So we want to hear a little bit about a patient. Marissa, you have a 36-year-old patient who actually received olaparib, a very, very interesting case. The woman actually was diagnosed in 2013 while being pregnant, very challenging situation. At that point, is found to have a germline mutation. I don't know what her family history is. That might be interesting to ask her about. But she went through a lot in terms of metastatic disease, brain met. I want to just focus in the interest of time, though, on what happened over the last 15 months. Maybe you can talk a little bit, Marissa, about kind of what her situation was at that point that she started the olaparib and what happened.
I'll give you a little insight, but I know Dr. O'Shaughnessy knows this patient really, really well. Since I've only been around for about a year or so, since I've started seeing her, I believe in the December of 2018, she began the olaparib. And prior to that, she was on different therapies. She had had progression of disease, and so she began the olaparib. But she is a very young lady and has a family, teaches full-time. And so initially when she began this, I think, you know, Dr. O'Shaughnessy said she had nausea for the first month or so, but overall she's tolerated therapy extremely well. and she hasn't had any progressive disease. She's been on it now for about 15 months and done it extremely well and had good quality of life while being on it, which is important.
So yeah, Joyce, Marissa was saying she just joined you a year ago. I was just trying to imagine walking in and starting out in your clinic. But she looks pretty tough. I think
she's tough. She's very calm. She's very calm.
I like it.
We balance each other.
Good balance. Yin and yang. Anyhow, I wouldn't even ask you about the story when she started, because that sounds really fascinating. Maybe we can talk about that another time. But Joyce, what was her condition? And I guess she has a 7-year-old now from that pregnancy?
She has 4 children, yeah. And she has a 7-year-old, yeah, 4 kids.
Wow. And you know, at ONS in the past, we've spent a lot of time talking about management of patients with minor children, such an important, huge topic. We might get into that during this series at some point in time. But Joyce, what was her condition when she started the olaparib, and how did she do in the beginning? Did she have any, a lot of people talk about GI problems. Did she have anything like that?
Well, this woman, you know, she's had metastatic disease now for some years, but I think her immune system is at least partially effective against her cancer because she's just never developed large volume disease. When she progresses with small volume disease. So she really did benefit from the pembrolizumab that she was on. She was on that for quite a long time, and then she developed a small amount of progression. So she had never had a PARP inhibitor, because when she was first diagnosed, we didn't have PARP inhibitors. So I decided she really needed a PARP inhibitor. She's had a very, very nice response. As Marissa said, she was pretty chronically nauseated, as Marissa said, for the first month or two. She was working full time. She was taking care of her family. So it was not debilitating, but she was taking antiemetics pretty much scheduled. But then one day it disappeared entirely. Very interesting. She didn't have any other GI toxicity, really no other toxicity. Maybe a little tiredness, but she's a very tough woman. But the nausea was not.
Did she respond? Did the tumor shrink?
Yes, she's had a very nice response in her disease that's sort of deep inside her chest wall between her ribs and in lung metastases as well. And so she's done very, very well with it over the 15 months.
So I should mention that for all these meetings, I spent about an hour with each one of the faculty. They did a presentation for me. I interviewed them, and we're going to put all this together into an enduring program. So even though you participate tonight, and we're happy that you did, we have tons more content on breast cancer that we're going to be posting for you to go through. I'm sure there are a lot of questions, and hopefully some of the additional content and presentation will be helpful. I want to finish out now and talk about the management of ER positive, in general, HER2 negative disease, because triple positive is another story. We're going to talk about ER positive, HER2 negative disease. And we could talk a lot about local therapy and genomic assays. I saw some questions coming on that. But we're going to focus today on metastatic disease because, again, we have a relatively recent approval of an important agent that we need to talk a little bit about. So we're going to talk about new agents in metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, particularly CDK4/6 inhibitors that have been out there for a few years, and now the more recent drug, the PI3 kinase inhibitor, alpelisib. So just in terms of some basics about how hormonal therapy works, Virginia, I was just doing an interview this morning with Rob Dreiser. He's going to be on the prostate cancer program here. He was going through the biology and endocrinology of prostate cancer. Can you talk a little bit, Virginia, about endocrine therapy of breast cancer and the difference? You know, we asked this question here, does fulvestrant work the same as tamoxifen? It's just IM, and the answer is no, it's actually very different. Can you just briefly review, before we kind of get into CDK and alpelisib, Virginia, how hormonal therapy works?
So the target in ER-positive breast cancer is the estrogen receptor, and there's 3 classes of agents that we now use as far as endocrine therapy. Tamoxifen, which is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, which means that it modulates the estrogen receptor. In some tissues, it works as an anti-estrogen, so it inhibits the ER. In other tissues, it works as an anti-estrogen. So based on the fact that in breast, it works as an anti-estrogen, it inhibits the ER and therefore kills breast cancer cells. Aromatase inhibitors inhibit aromatase, so they prevent estrogen from being formed altogether. And so therefore, it can't bind the estrogen receptor, it can't kill breast cancer cells, or it can't promote breast cancer. And then finally, fulvestrant is an estrogen receptor downregulator, which basically means it destroys the estrogen receptor. So very different actions. One, it inhibits the receptor with tamoxifen. The other one doesn't allow estrogen to be formed with aromatase inhibitors. And the other one, fulvestrant, destroys the estrogen receptor.
So let's talk about two of the newer advances in terms of this ER-positive disease. And one is the use of CDK4/6 inhibitors. We'll show you the data in a second. These are just some warm-up questions we put in there. And we'll hear about the fact that palbociclib and ribociclib seem to have a similar toxicity profile, more oriented around neutropenia, and then abemaciclib, less neutropenia, but more GI toxicity. And we'll talk about how that plays out. The one where you have to check the EKG is a ribociclib as well. And then finally, alpelisib that's used in people with PI3 kinase inhibitors. I'm going to just sort of skip this thing and get into CDK4/6 inhibitors, Virginia. And if you can talk a little bit about, you know, your vision of how these agents work and why is it that we're combining it with hormonal therapy?
So CDK4/6 inhibitors, as the slide you just showed depicts so clearly, they cause arrest of the cell cycle. And so the cell cannot replicate and therefore it'll die. And we combine them with several treatments, and now there's nice data in HER2-positive disease as well, but mostly in the ER-positive setting, when you combine that with an anti-estrogen therapy, as you can see here, the two pathways are very related. And therefore, when you combine a CDK4/6 inhibitor with either an aromatase inhibitor or fulvestrant, you get a really nice response and a good cell death.
Good cell death. That sounds a little interesting.
Cancer cell death.
What about side effects? You know, I mentioned the fact that sort of it looks to me like when I hear you talking about it, you kind of break them down into palbo and ribo versus abemaciclib. Marissa, can you talk a little bit about your experience with these agents and what you've seen in terms of tolerability, particularly again as it relates to these two problems that we see different amounts of, GI and neutropenia? How much of the problem is the neutropenia, incidentally, Marissa?
I know with palbo and ribo, we definitely watch patients a little bit closer as we get them started on therapy to make sure their blood counts are managing and they aren't dropping too much within the first, you know, month or two. But really, I think they're all overall well tolerated. Definitely the more diarrhea with the abemaciclib, you know, can be more of a challenge. But overall, I think patients tolerate them well.
So Joyce, we had a question in there about management of premenopausal patients, and I put in postmenopausal patients because in general, that's the way to look at the fact that you have a premenopausal patient, you make her postmenopausal, and then you treat her the same way as a postmenopausal patient.
Yes, that's exactly right, Neil. We treat the premenopausal woman who has ER-positive metastatic breast cancer. We treat her the same as postmenopausal women, except that we need to add an LHRH agonist, the gosarilin or the leuprolide, to her either fulvestrant or her aromatase inhibitor with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, and she benefits exactly the same as the postmenopausal women from the CDK4/6 inhibitors.
Of course, you know, postmenopausal breast cancer is much more common, so there are many more patients in clinical trials, and it was actually a while before we started to see data specifically related to premenopausal patients. This MONALEESA 3 study, I think, was one of the first ones, if not the first one, to really do that. Any comments about that, Joyce, and you know, sort of how CDK inhibition, specifically ribociclib, played out in premenopausal women? It looks kind of like the same way it plays out in postmenopausal women.
Yeah, this is a beautiful curve here. This is an overall survival benefit in the first-line setting of premenopausal women, combining the non-steroidal AI, an aromatase inhibitor, with ribociclib, plus an LHRH agonist, gosarilin or leuprolide, compared to no ribociclib. Really, really nice to see a 29% reduction in the risk of death. So this has really become, for sure, the standard of care for our first-line premenopausal ER-positive metastatic patients.
Daniel, any comment on treating younger women, you know, ablating the ovaries, suppressing the ovaries, you know, causing sort of premature menopause? Now we're adding things on top of that. What have you observed in terms of how patients tolerate these strategies?
Well, typically, like you said, especially when they do ovarian function suppression, you know, the biggest side effect that I've seen, especially in the younger women is the hot flashes are usually the biggest bothering symptom that I've noticed with the women. So, you know, helping them manage that symptom, making sure we're keeping it controlled, because it can be very bothersome if they're out and about and then they get a supreme hot flash and they're sweating. You know, it just can be really uncomfortable. So that, in my experience, has been usually one of the more biggest concern from our patients is these hot flashes that can really be very bothersome to our patients. So we just do what we can to help manage them. In some cases, we add medications to really help suppress that hot flash side effect. So it just varies per woman. Some don't get it, some do. Just I tell every patient, everybody's different and everybody reacts differently. We'll just kind of monitor them and go as we treat, really.
So the other thing we want to talk about in terms of ER-positive metastatic disease is this new agent that we now have. And like so many agents in oncology, it requires a test, an assay that has to be positive in order to utilize it. So Virginia, can you talk a little bit about how we were approaching women who got first-line therapy? So for some years now, that's been a CDK inhibitor plus endocrine therapy and then disease progression. What were we doing previously, and what are we doing now?
Previously, we would give another anti-estrogen therapy, could be fulvestrant, possibly in combination with an mTOR inhibitor. Now, and Joyce mentioned this before, when we have a patient with metastatic disease, I usually do two things. First of all, I test them for BRCA, and secondly, I test them for PIK3CA mutations if they're ER positive or PD-L1 if they're ER negative. And this gives me the option of potentially giving a PI3 kinase inhibitor such as alpelisib.
And can you talk a little bit about the research that led us to use alpelisib in these patients with these PIK3 mutations, Virginia? And what we know about PIK3 mutations to start with, I think they're fairly common in breast cancer. And also take a look at the results when alpelisib was used. We can put that slide up. But can you talk a little bit about how alpelisib actually works, why we use it in these patients, Virginia, and then what kind of benefit that we get from treating them?
So in ER-positive metastatic disease, around 40% of the patients will have a PIK3CA mutation, so a mutation in PI3 kinase. And those patients, the tumor really is driven by the PIK3CA, and therefore a medication like alpelisib, which is an inhibitor of PI3 kinase and the alpha subunit, and that's different from several other inhibitors that are in the market, some in lymphoma and other diseases. And so the patients with these PIK3CA mutations, as seen in the slide, had a significant improvement in progression-free survival when alpelisib was added to fulvestrant. The patients that were PIK3CA negative, because they were included in that clinical trial too, had no benefit from alpelisib.
And somebody in the chat room I saw brought up the fact that other CDK inhibitors used in premenopausal women, we have data on, including Palbo. So it's not just ribociclib. What about tolerability issues, Joyce? What kind of problems do you get into with alpelisib?
Hyperglycemia is the main one. The key on alpelisib is don't give it to patients whose glucose is not under control. Their hemoglobin A1C has to be less than 6.5%. If you do that and they home monitor, come into the office, start them on some metformin, if they get above 160 on their glucose, they'll be okay. But hyperglycemia is the key one, and also super important. You got to give prophylactic non-drowsy antihistamine at least daily. The package insert says daily, but I use a BID, you know, Zyrtec or Claritin, et cetera, BID to prevent rash. Because once it starts, it's hard to treat the rash. So you want to prevent the rash. But I will tell you that women lose a lot of weight on alpelisib. We do high fives all around on that one. Just did that today. Did a high five. And so sometimes you have to reduce the dose because the weight loss gets quite substantial.
And what's the mechanism of the weight loss? Is it related to diabetes or something separate?
It's blocking the pathway whereby cells take in glucose. So I guess that makes you lose weight, Neil. I don't know. I'm like, this ought to be used for our obesity problem. It's really quite profound.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, I heard somebody talking about lenvatinib in the same way. But anyhow, let's finish out with a couple of cases of people actually got these therapies. And again, without going into details, Marissa, you have this 58-year-old lady. I just want to find out what happened when she got, obviously she had a bunch of therapies before, but when she got fulvestrant alpelisib, it looks like she required a dose range. So she was one of these people who lost weight, I guess, that Joyce was just talking about. What happened there, Marissa? She was just, was she unable to eat? She wasn't, was it diabetes or what happened?
I think like Dr. O'Shaughnessy said, you know, she really, I mean, overall was tolerating the medication. I think I had taken some notes within the first few months she had lost about 20 pounds. So I don't know if it was a problem that she wasn't eating, you know, because we watched their blood sugar so closely. But like Dr. O'Shaughnessy said, we had to dose reduce her and her weight stabilized after that.
So, and we'll just finish out with Daniel's case. So he had a 44-year-old lady who also had a mutation that led her to be treated with alpelisib and fulvestrant. And again, just focusing on what happened, it looks like she got started on this in February, Daniel. What, it looks like she had some problems, but then you adjusted things and she's doing well at this point. What's going on?
Yeah, she's doing great right now on the alpelisib. Actually, she just had recent staging scans, and so far everything looked pretty stable. So, you know, we'll restage again in about 3 months to see how the patient's disease, you know, if she's stable or not. But as far as the side effect profile, it actually hasn't been too bad. We haven't had any of the issues about hyperglycemia with her, so we'll just kind of keep playing it by ear. But so far, she's been doing pretty good, and I'm glad that her recent staging scans were still stable. So we'll just kind of keep an eye on it.
So, Virginia, any comments about this woman and her course, and particularly what happened when she started the alpelisib fulvestrant?
I was pretty surprised that she did not have much hyperglycemia. As you may know, you know, 3/4 of San Antonio are diabetics, and the ones that are not also have some sort of glucose intolerance. But she tolerated the medication well. As Joyce mentioned, the rash can be a little bit of an issue. You can have a little bit of diarrhea, but it's extremely important. And on that clinical trial, the hemoglobin A1C had to be less than 6.5 for patients to be eligible. So if we have the general U.S. population where everybody is obese and many people are diabetics, we have to be very careful before we start the medication.
So I want to really thank everyone who attended tonight. Thanks to the faculty.